Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is February 11th, 2026, and this is episode 581. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, out in Western New York State. You are listening to Radio Warner. Subscribe and support the show. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warner. All one word, type it in and subscribe and support us. And I'm on the line, of course, with the Warner himself, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher in Puglia. John, how you doing?
Great. Puglia is nice and quiet now that the weekend's over. It's like a weird combination of bad childhood memories, like combination of people mowing their lawns, cutting down trees, and learning to ride motorcycles, all things that made me, for various reasons, very depressed. All the motorcycles sound like all three of those combined. And
I was going to say, they're not mowing lawns there, are they?
No.
Yeah, but lawn mowers sound like, the motorcycles evoke all those bad memories.
I see.
Yeah. They like their motorcycles down there?
Oh, God, yeah. If you want to be a macho guy in a EU culture, what do? I mean, I don't know.
Put on the leather and get your motorcycle revved up, I guess. Yeah. So you probably don't get as much relaxation on the weekend.
No.
With those motorcycles.
Unfortunately, it gets to me. Sometimes do, some don't. That does.
Yeah. Yeah, I can understand. All right. Well, today we have a great guest coming on, Jennifer Cavanaugh, to talk about one of the subjects that we have been sort of, that has appeared in many episodes of, you know, not just the 10 years that we've been doing Radio Warner, but especially over the last couple of years, which is missiles and missile defense. There's a lot out there on drones. There are a lot of open source experts on drones, a lot of talk about it because drones are newer and the drone warfare evolution is fast. And, you know, we see it in Ukraine, of course, and elsewhere. Sudan, but not a lot on missiles and sort of the economics and physics of missiles versus anti-missile technologies.
Because if you watched the Iranian strikes on Tel Aviv, for example, it's like there were some new and scary missiles that moved like missiles in a sci-fi movie, like darting here, there, and everywhere, and then blowing up.
Yeah. And this is what, you know, I think this is a big story. I mean, the proliferation of non-nuclear ballistic missile technologies, which have made it cheaper and easier to produce and deploy versus the still very expensive anti-missile air defense systems. So let's get to our discussion with Jennifer Cavanaugh. Okay, we are very honored to have with us today our guest, Jennifer Cavanaugh. She's a senior fellow and director of military analysis at Defense Priorities and had a great article in Responsible Statecraft that we're going to want to discuss about missiles and missile defense and all this. So first of all, Jennifer, thanks for coming on Radio Warner.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into missiles, and we'll have a few questions about that, but you're currently in Germany. You're in Munich, right? Because you're there for the Munich Security Conference. So I assume you're in Munich.
Yes, that's correct.
Right. So, side note, we've been doing a series on debunking myths about the infamous 1938 Munich Agreement, which, it's mostly about talking about how it's been instrumentalized by neocons and the like to always advocate for war and warmongering. But anyway, there's that. But you said, I'll be curious what you're seeing there. You said you were just in Budapest for sort of the anti-Munich security conference. It's called the Budapest Global Dialogue. Can you describe what that means to be the anti-Munich security conference and what went on at the Budapest Global Dialogue?
Well, I think this is this year was the third Budapest Global Dialogue, and it's not always this week. So it just happens this year to be the same week as the Munich security conference. But the goal of it is really to surface and discuss the ways in which the international security architecture and the quote-unquote rules-based international order is changing and what comes next. I think there's a real agreement, at least at this dialogue, there was really an agreement that the rules-based order is dead and no one's really sure what comes next. And so the discussions were about how we think about peace and peacemaking, war, and its a likelihood in the future, the future of AI and energy, values, these types of things, and how they might interact in this future security architecture. And so, you know, I just kind of half jokingly call it the anti-Munich because it's a very different perspective on the world. And you know, I don't know what will happen this year at Munich. Obviously, it hasn't started yet, but in the past, it's really been an effort to bolster and protect the consensus that's existed since the end of World War II, and especially since the end of the Cold War, and anything that deviates from that is seen as kind of shocking and right. Destabilizing, right? And that was Vance's speech last year and
right.
The U.S. position. So, you know, those positions that Vance articulated and that the Trump administration has been pushing on Europe, burden shifting and U.S. retrenchment and the ideas that came through in Trump's national security and national defense strategy, these are sort of centered at the Budapest Global Dialogue, where I think here in Munich, they're still scary right. To a lot of Europeans.
Well, yeah, Trump's agenda must be kind of hard to interpret for a lot of these people who want to speak for his administration at that conference, because it's sort of like, we're not giving you anything anymore. Go to hell. we need to rearm.
Yeah, well, this year will be interesting because, you know, Vance isn't coming, but Rubio is. And Rubio's position on Europe has been a little bit more status quo and conventional compared to Vance and others. And so I think the question is sort of what message does he send? And how does Europe interpret that? You know, I've heard from Europeans over the past year, you know, the relationship has changed. It can never go back to the way it was.
Yes.
But then kind of behind closed doors, they're like, what they really hope that it does go back to what it was, that
yes.
someone else comes in 2028
exactly.
and reestablishes it.
We just need to wait out this loon.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they did the last time, too, the first Trump administration. And
right.
it seemed to have worked. And then Biden was a disaster. And now we have a much more souped up Trump. And it's like, okay, well, let's pretend like we get it and wait for the next guy. Is that
good? Yeah. So I'm kind of interested to see what will happen, like what Rubio will say, and like what the mood will be with the Europeans. Like, are they really serious, or are we still kind of hand-wringing? Because, you know, my view is that Europe is very strong. I have much more confidence in Europe's ability to defend itself than Europe does. So I kind of wish they would just recognize that, like, you know, if they would even just organize themselves a little bit and coordinate, they could be so much stronger than the Russian army that there's really nothing for them to worry about. But still, they seem to be flailing around. And
Russia has not fully, I don't mean to belittle it. I know it's a different, tougher war, but they've still not fully captured Chasiv Yar. I think they have like 97% of Chasiv Yar. They're not going to be storming into Berlin anytime soon.
No.
Like,
the lack of any article saying that after years of Russian failure in the Ukraine war was deafening, as they say.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's this narrative in Russia in the United States, some quarters of Washington D.C. as well as in Europe that Russia is weak, that we just need to put more pressure on Russia, more economic pressure will cause it to collapse. And then at the same time, we're terrified that Russia's going to invade the Baltics and take Poland and, you know, be storming Berlin in a few weeks. And those messages are inconsistent. Either Russia is strong. Either Russia is strong and will be in Berlin soon, or it is weak and can be forced to stop fighting through economic sanctions. Now, I think the reality is somewhere in the middle.
Right.
You know, it's unfortunate that we kind of just yo-yo back and forth between these really extreme and unrealistic positions.
Yeah. Mm. I just wanted to ask real quickly about going back to the Budapest Global Dialogue versus immunity. Like, who is at the Budapest Global Dialogue? I mean, it sounds like they're trying to... That group is more like trying to shape or think about and seriously this kind of post rules-based liberal international order world and trying to imagine it and implement it and so on. And the Munich Security Conference is status quo and trying to hold on whatever way possible to what they've had because it's served at least the political elites of Europe, you know, very well up to now. Who goes to the Budapest Global Dialogue? I mean, I imagine Kaya Kallas isn't there, but like, who goes there?
It's a very international group, and we had keynote speeches from members of Orban's government, as well as governments from you know, nearby countries, Eastern European countries. And how they're dealing with the changing world order as small states, which was, you know, interesting. There are people, you know, there were people from the U.S., there were people from all over Europe. I think it's more, it's less location-based and more, like, mentality-based. People who, like, you know, recognize that the rules-based order was always a fiction, that, you know, American military primacy actually didn't serve anyone's interests, including America's, and that like a that change is good and welcome, even if we are, you know, even if it's hard to grapple with the uncertainty of not knowing what comes next. I think it's a group of people that are optimistic about the fact that we're finally acknowledging that this old thing didn't work that well, or at least doesn't work anymore, and we need something new. And it will take time for that new thing to emerge.
Right. Okay. So, let's talk missiles now and missile defense.
I wanted to ask a sort of historical question because, I mean, my background in all this is that I'm like one of the sad creatures who used to read Aviation Week and Armed Forces Journal and all those things in the UC Berkeley Public Library. You know, I don't even want to talk about what kind of life I had because I didn't have any. I grew up doing that, and I came to some conclusions over a long, hard time that are perhaps more common now. There are two basic problems. One is that the U.S. is entangled in a number of alliances, and it realizes belatedly in its entanglement with each alliance that its newest and shiniest weapons are the best and only they will do. So we have to shift them abroad. And then it realizes somewhat simultaneously or a little bit later that it's spent a lot of money on those shiny weapons and it doesn't have that many of them. And meanwhile, it's stopped funding its Chevy Oldsmobile weapons that work pretty well but aren't very exciting or interesting to procurement officers. So how do you interpret in this panic about missiles supplied to Israel and Ukraine, how do you interpret that in terms of this panic?
So I think the problem here is a little bit different than that. I mean, it's definitely true that the air defense missiles that the U.S. has invested in are expensive, and we produce them at a very slow rate. But this is not just a problem of aiming for sort of exquisite missiles when something cheaper would do. The technology for offensive missiles and drones has developed much more quickly, and we are at a place where the unit cost is much lower than is the case for counter-missile and counter-drone systems. So this is true also in the drone space. Even though we've made tons of progress in producing cheap drones, the counter UAS or counter drone technologies are still quite expensive. And so there's this imbalance in the cost ratio in between the offensive side and the defensive side that extends not only to missiles but also to drones.
This came out clearly when Iraq started launching Scuds at Israel. I mean, you could loan Israel as many anti-missile missiles as possible, but a big, big missile that's like a giant rock aimed at a certain place doesn't need very sophisticated coordination to reach that place, and it just has to explode. So yeah, there's no equality.
Yeah, I think what this allows is for even small countries and militant groups to build lots of cheap missiles or cheap drones and overwhelm air defenses because you don't have enough air interceptors to intercept them all. And at some point, the targeting systems just become so overwhelmed and the number of missiles you would need to hit all the targets is so large because you usually need more than one interceptor per incoming missile, that it just becomes unsustainable. Not only is it difficult to target when you're being swarmed by dozens or, in the case of drones, hundreds of drones, but also you just don't have enough. And so you don't have to, an adversary doesn't have to have good missiles. It just has to have a lot of them.
Right.
And it doesn't even need to be able to hit the right targets. They just need to be able to explode because eventually the idea is that the defender will run out of air defense or their air defense systems will fail. And then you can just kind of wreak havoc whether you hit, you know, a military target or you're blowing up a shopping mall. It doesn't matter to most of these adversaries. So that's the challenge that we face.
That's such a great point. I mean, there's the issue of scarcity. Missiles did not used to be so cheap and were a bit more kind of luxurious, I guess. But it's pretty amazing now. You know, you have Russia, of course, is missile missile sort of arsenal is really kind of, I think most people have really focused on the drones, which is new and more exciting. And not a lot of people have really focused on the missiles. And, you know, if you follow the war closely, I mean, you notice that the Iskanders, for example, have absolutely wreaked havoc, or the sort of the cab, you know, the retrofitted air-launched sort of bombs with guidance on them, like the Topols. I mean, all these different missiles and the North Korean missiles as well have really wreaked havoc. And the drones, like they've calibrated over time, same with the Iranians and I guess even the Yemenis, these sort of cocktails or strike packages that include different drones and different missiles, of course, cruise missiles and ballistic missiles and even some hypersonic missiles in order to degrade and overwhelm anti-missile systems. So on the one side, you have an issue of scarcity because I guess it's just from the side of the anti-missile systems, it's just more expensive, higher tech, harder to produce. And on the other side, it turns out to be sort of like drones, easier to produce missiles that are increasingly effective and can carry large payloads. Do you see it that way at all?
Yeah, I agree that there are a couple intertwined problems here. One is the scarcity issue. We just don't have enough air defense interceptors. Another, and we can't produce them fast enough. Another is the cost problem. Air defense interceptors are much more costly than the offensive weapons. And then there's sort of a, I don't know what exactly to call it, like a geometry problem or a physics problem in the sense that any sort of targeting system can only identify so many targets before it's overwhelmed. And what the Russians have done very well is to overwhelm air defense systems with like decoy drones, which are cheap and not important at all. And then the missiles get through because the air defense systems can't properly target on the missiles when there's so many drones like interfering with their, their detection. Or they have to concentrate on one missile. They can't hit, you know, the 30 that are coming in at once. So, so there's kind of three problems there: the number problem, the scarcity problem, the cost problem, and then this problem of sort of just the way in which air defense systems work and the sort of swarming capability on the offensive side. You can't really swarm air defenses, at least not yet.
Right. If we could go to your article about, because this is a really interesting article about, I don't think people really know this, about speaking of scarcity, the scarcity of U.S. anti-air, anti-missile systems, as Trump has moved all kinds of assets to threaten and or actually bomb Iran again. It turns out a lot of our best systems have also, certainly the missiles for them or the interceptors, have already been sold to Ukraine. I mean, can you describe like specifically the shortfall, the scarcity issue that we're dealing with now? Because Trump is, seems very active in a lot of theaters.
Yeah, so, you know, the issue doesn't start with Trump. The issue starts back with, well, you know, probably decades ago. But let's start with the Biden administration. You know, we had stockpiles that we considered to be, you know, mostly sufficient for the challenges that we faced. Turns out that probably our defense industrial base wasn't ready for a real war. But, you know, I think we saw in World War II the speed with which the United States is able to ramp up defense production when it really, really has to. So I guess that's less concerning to me. But the Biden administration was very focused initially on this sort of as long as it takes strategy for Ukraine, which meant that they wanted to arm Ukraine as much as possible, as quickly as possible. And so they used a number of different vehicles or mechanisms to get Ukraine weapons quickly. And the fastest way to get weapons to Ukraine was to take them out of U.S. stocks. And send them to Ukraine directly, and then backfill. The idea being the U.S. wasn't in active conflict right now, didn't expect to be in the sort of near to medium term. So the best use of these missiles and other weapons was to send them to Ukraine, and then the U.S. would have a deficit, but we'd fill it in. The problem is that this kind of went on for too long, and it drained. They were willing to drain stockpiles to levels that, you know, other people like me, you know, were raising a red flag and saying, like, is this a good idea? Now, I am like a restrainer, and some people would call me a radical restrainer in the sense that I don't want to do less in Europe so we can pivot to Asia. I want to do less everywhere. So I don't. So while sensible. I'm concerned, while I'm concerned about stockpile depth. I'm concerned about it not because I think we need more missiles to fight China. I'm concerned about it because it removes strategic flexibility. I'd always rather live in a world where we're asking, you know, should the U.S. do this? Does it make sense? Is it in U.S. interests? Rather than being in a place where we have to ask the question, can we do this? Do we have the missiles to do this? Because then you're in a world where your decisions aren't based on U.S. interests. They're based on resource constraints. And I think that's a much worse place to be. So that's why I'm concerned about this. But the Biden administration kept, you know, giving it weapons from stocks. And they also had this other vehicle, which was the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, which was basically money that was paid for by the U.S. government, but they were contracts, longer-term contracts of weapons that would go to Ukraine over time. So the contract was signed in, say, 2023, but the weapons would be delivered in 2026. So this was compounded, this sort of like draining of U.S. stockpiles and pressure on the U.S. defense industrial base was compounded then after October 7th when Hamas attacked Israel. And the Biden administration basically took the same approach to Israel, which was we have to give them everything that we need. And in some cases, they needed the same things that Ukraine, the same things as Ukraine. So now you're really draining stockpiles because you're sending your air defense missiles and your 155 ammunition and other types of sort of already scarce capabilities. Air defense was probably the place where we see the shortages the most starkly because this is a place where there's very high global demand, where production is already slow, and it was needed so badly. It was needed by Israel to protect itself from Hamas's, you know, very poor but still able to explode rockets. And it was needed by Ukraine facing a massive air attacks from Russia. So we already are seeing sort of very significant demand on these capabilities. So when Trump came in, he put an end to this draining of U.S. stockpiles mostly. He has not issued any more of this the direct withdrawals from U.S. stocks. But the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative pipeline remains. And so there's about $19 billion worth of weapons that have been promised to Ukraine, which will be delivered over the next 2 years. There have been no new awards. This is still holdover from Biden, but they continue to come off U.S. production lines, which means that the U.S. is competing with Ukraine for things like Patriot missiles and other types of weapons. Now, we don't have a good sense, really, of exactly how much Ukraine is getting compared to how much the U.S. is getting. But we know how high Ukraine's demands are. Mm-hmm. And we know, especially in air defense, we know how slow production is. So there's just not that. If you're giving some of it to Ukraine, even if you're giving a little bit of it to Ukraine, it's a big percentage of the total because the total is not very big. Because there's another mechanism here through which weapons are getting to Ukraine, which I think is the more deceptive one. Mm-hmm. It's this Pearl mechanism, which Trump has billed as the Europeans are paying for weapons. And this is his big narrative, which is the United States isn't paying for this anymore. Europe is paying for it. And that's mostly true, except the way Pearl works is it basically gives Europe and, you know, by extension, Ukraine, priority place in the production line, which means that the orders of other buyers, including orders that would go to the United States, are delayed in part or in full. We don't know, again, exactly how long or exactly how much Ukraine gets, but we know they go right to the front of the line when the money shows up. Which, again, delays the replenishment of U.S. stocks and leaves the U.S., you know, in this position of deficit. And then the final piece of the puzzle is the U.S. government recognizes this. They're not being completely honest with the American public about how much we're still giving to Ukraine. In order to kind of backfill, there's been all this attention on trying to expand the defense industrial base and invest so much more to increase production. And it's true, we do need to do some additional expansion to produce more air interceptors, so we're not facing this problem anymore. But probably that investment could be a lot smaller if we weren't sending such a large chunk of what we're making, like directly out to Ukraine and other places. So, and that money, the money to expand the defense industrial base, that does come from taxpayer dollars, because that is in the appropriation. So the point that I'm trying to make in this article is that we think we're hearing that the U.S. is doing nothing, the U.S. has abandoned Ukraine, the U.S. isn't paying for weapons anymore, and that's just not true. The U.S. is still paying for weapons, and it is still costing the U.S. military readiness. And I'm, you know, I don't take a strong position in the article on whether we should stop aiding Ukraine at all, but at some point we have to decide, you know, how much are we willing to give and how significant is the deficit and how much does it put U.S. interests at risk?
One thing that struck me in terms of, what some analysts have called this addiction to gold plating in the military and the drive to run up costs for a perfect weapon rather than lots of bad weapons, as demonstrated in the A-10 controversy recently. But one problem with that is that, as many commentators have said, dull weapons that work tend not to get funded. And the thing is, like 155-millimeter shells, they work, as shown in Ukraine, but they're not very interesting to produce. They're only, unless you make a copperhead shell or something, there aren't too many bells and whistles, as the saying goes, that you can attach to them. So is there any awareness of that in the military?
Yeah, I'm sorry, to back up what John said, you know, when the war, sort of the Ukraine war after Russia's invasion in February 2022, by sort of the summer, fall, everyone knew that Ukraine certainly needed a lot of 155 millimeter, a lot of shells. And at the same time, there was a lot of talk that Russia, because of the sanctions, which were unprecedented, and there were nuclear sanctions and so on, that Russia was a gas station with nukes, that it was going to run out of its capacity to produce shells. And instead, what we've seen is Russian production is up to what I think the Financial Times said, now like 7 million shells a year. Like, it's massively ramped up, along with missiles and drones. And the U.S., as far as I can tell, in Europe in particular, like, they were, the rich countries were supposed to have completely outpaced Russia in that way. And they have put some money in, but they're still not producing enough. It's kind of mind-blowing.
In the Russian case, I think there's a few things at play. I think, first of all, it's important to remember that for Russia, especially for Putin, this is an existential war. This is like the most important thing. And they're willing to pour as much money as it takes into defense production, whereas that's just not the case in Europe or the United States. And there's a good reason for that. It's because Ukraine is not existential for Europe or or the United States. So, you know, we can fault them for not investing enough, or we can recognize that states act in their interests and they're not going to do it until they actually feel that the threat is real. So all this talk about how the, you know, the war in Ukraine is existential for Europe and Europe is going to invade Ukraine in 2026 or 2027 or whatever ridiculous date they're predicting now, like, that doesn't match with their actions. So to me, this all this wailing about the Russian threat is really just an effort to keep the U.S. in and prevent the retrenchment that they see coming. But, you know, in Russia, that's not the case. This is an existential war, and Putin has really rallied and put the Russian economy under significant strain in order to produce as much as possible. They've also have some advantages. You know, first of all, it's not a democracy. So they have the ability to sort of direct manufacturing capacity in a way that is not the case in Europe and the United States, at least not during peacetime. Second, they had a lot of excess defense capacity or excess manufacturing capacity left over from the Cold War. Like a lot of the factories
entire giant cities built around defense plants. Yeah, I visited some of those back in the 90s. Yeah, just crazy.
Yeah, so I mean, they have that to back it up. And they've relied heavily on, you know, initially they relied heavily on countries like Iran and North Korea to help fill the gaps. Now, they don't really need Iran anymore. And, you know, North Korea continues to provide, you know, cheap stuff, but they've been able to leverage that. You know, China hasn't helped them in that way, but because they, you know, China's has adhered more closely to international sanctions. But, yeah, so, I mean, you know, when we think about, you know, why Russia's been so much more successful, I think that's why. You know, in the U.S. military, to go back to the kind of previous question, I agree that this gold plating is a problem, this need to have everything be bespoke and, you know, so advanced distracts from the fact that you could do a lot with, like, cheaper weapon systems. And I don't know if they would never get funded. I think the appeal of some of these big fancy programs is that they, you know, they play into this whole military-industrial complex that we have in the United States, right? Like they get backers from across all states because they have parts in all states, and they become sort of the symbol of American
the politics of production and everything.
And it's also this idea that we need to have the best and fanciest and most advanced stuff to have the superiority and dominance that's required, instead of recognizing that as strategies change, we need different weapons. And a great example is this F-47 jet that we're apparently going to build, right? Like, if you talk to most air power analysts, they'll tell you, like, the era in which the United States could guarantee air dominance or air superiority in a conflict, especially a near-peer conflict like one with China, like, those are past. Yep. It's not even a useful goal to aim for. So there's no point in investing more in making sure that you have air superiority, because you're not going to have it, whether you have F-35 or F-47 or F-whatever, you know? It doesn't matter. And instead, we should be thinking about lower-cost drones and cheaper systems, uncrewed aircraft of different styles and types, that these are the types of things that are going to that are going to really, really matter. Being able to produce a lot of those things is in some ways better than having a few of these really exquisite systems. The other problem, of course, is that these really fancy, exquisite systems are often so complex and based on emerging technologies that never come to fruition. So you end up spending a ton of money and you get no real systems because they are just, they're like a little too cute, right? So that's the problem with the LCS. Like, it was supposed to be have these modules, and none of the modules it's the Littoral Combat Ship. So it's supposed to be this, like, it's supposed to be this, like, light, you know, a vessel that was good for all the types of littoral types of activities that the Navy expected to do in Asia and elsewhere. And it's been basically useless. Like, they don't even really use them in Latin America.
There was a notable lack of American naval power, so-called, in the so-called invasion of Venezuela. What there was an aircraft carrier far off the coast ferrying Navy SEALs just... you know, small kill teams into the
Delta Force. And a lot of jamming, right? I would imagine just a lot of electronic jamming.
Well, you know, I think this is sort of the new model of air defense, right? If we can't have a lot of air defense interceptors, what countries are doing instead is to have these layered air defenses. So you start with jamming. That's the simplest way to get rid of drones and to interfere with another country's targeting capabilities and things like that. Then you move on to sort of cheaper kinetic counter-drone technologies or cheaper types of air defense interceptors. And then you move on to the really expensive ones, the Patriot, the THAAD, things like that. That's the idea, is that you use these layers, and that's what Ukraine has done actually quite effectively. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've taken a lot of damage, but given the number of incoming missiles and drones that they face, they've actually done quite well using this layer strategy.
Right. Speaking of gold-plated, but actually, as far as I can tell, a genuinely very effective air defense system and very gold-plated, the THAAD system. As I understand it, there are only 7 or 8 systems built, and then each system has 48 interceptors, which take forever to manufacture. Is that right? Can you describe the THAAD? I remember that when it was in development in the 90s, even the Russians were freaking out about it because they had a sense that it was going to work and basically obviate, the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which we wound up tearing up anyway under Bush. But can you describe the THAAD system and how good it is and how scarce it is?
Yeah, I mean, you're right that there's only 7 of them. And a lot of them are actually right now deployed in the Middle East. So that's, we could talk about the wisdom of having like half of your THAAD systems in the Middle East, a region where the U.S. has almost no strategic interests. But it's probably a topic for a different day. So they have very few of these systems. The U.S. is working to manufacture more of them, but manufactures them at a very slow rate. The interceptor missiles that are used, I think, can produce only about 400 a year. So that's that's the target. The target is 400 per year. The current is only 100 per year. So right now we're it's like about 8 missiles per month, and they're aiming to be at 400 at some point in the near future. But obviously, there's a big difference between 100 and 400, so we're getting there. The reason why these are so effective is that they're able to sort of detect these ballistic missiles outside the atmosphere. So they're able to, they're very effective because of how early they can target them. Now, Patriot missiles can also intercept ballistic missiles, but they're less effective because they don't target them outside the atmosphere. So that's why THAAD missiles are considered sort of the best of the best. But they're not 100%. They're not perfect, and they're also quite exquisite. If you look at the 12-day war, the U.S. relied heavily on THAAD missiles to protect U.S. forces, but especially Israel, when air defenses started to run low.
Right.
And estimates are that in those 12 days, the U.S. burned through 25% of its THAAD missile stockpile, and that it will take at current production rates, so going back to the 100 per year, it will take 15 years to replace the missiles that were burned through in 12 days.
That's insane.
So,
right.
So that just shows you, and these were cheap Iranian missiles that didn't actually hit, do much damage. But this is sort of a great example of this imbalance.
So you mentioned the 12-day war, and there was a story buried in the, event coverage that really struck me. And it first struck me when I watched the television coverage of the Iranian strikes. That is, a lot of missiles seem to be getting through of the faster course control types. And then I saw a couple of stories about Israeli ministers saying anybody who reports these strikes is a traitor or something, and they firmly suppressed that story. So what I was wondering, since I saw your colleague Sam Lair's story on his own estimates of the Iranian missile successful strikes on Tel Aviv and Dimona, I think. And he said the Tel Aviv strikes probably landed 25% of the time. Was that a shock to anyone in the defense community?
I think it was a shock to some of the defense community. It wasn't really a shock to me. But, I think the reality is that the Iranian missile strikes did more damage than was let on. I think if the war had gone on for even a couple more days, the damage would have gotten a lot worse because
right,
at that
they
point,
seemed to be getting better as the war went on. Is that right?
Well, they were getting better, yeah. And Israel's air defenses were running out. And I think right. Iran's strategy improved in terms of how it was targeting.
Right.
I also think that Iran saved a lot of its ballistic missiles. It didn't use all of them, and it kind of was holding them back. The idea being that it also understood this imbalance between air defense interceptors and missiles, and the idea being that once Israel had burned through most of its air defense, then they would start with the better missiles. Now, the war ended before they could do that, but that's why you see continuing concern from the Israelis right now about Iran's ballistic missiles, because not only have they begun to reconstitute that infrastructure, their air defenses, and their production capabilities from the damage that Israel did, but they already had a pretty big stockpile. So, these missiles can reach Israel, and for Israel, that is a concern. Mm-hmm. And that is what Netanyahu is currently in D.C. talking to President Trump about. So I guess we'll see what happens.
Right. I have a question about the Ukraine war, again, going back to that, because it's been kind of a war of, in terms of the air side of it, the Russian side, as you said, initially they got some help from the Iranians, the Shahid, which has turned into the Gedan. The Gedan is, I think the newest models of the Gedan now, I mean, they look like cruise missiles. They're basically jet missiles, and they look very different from the early Shahids. But anyway, all of these missiles that the Russians are using, and their missile swarm, their missile package attacks, missile and drone attacks have definitely evolved to degrade the Ukrainian systems. And on the Ukrainian side, it's mostly been about air defense rather than about their own strike capabilities. They've tried to deploy some missiles. They've had some more luck, I guess, with drones. Once in a while, their drones break through and, blow up a refinery or kind of scare people in some of the cities, but they really haven't had a lot of success with drones, and definitely not with missiles. And I'm wondering if the main reason for that is that, I mean, why Ukraine? Ukraine has a lot of scientists and had also a very big defense industry. Like, I wonder why Ukraine has not been able to develop missiles on the scale of like Iran or North Korea or so, let alone Russia, and why none of the NATO countries will give, I guess, the deepest strike system that was approved for Ukraine was the ATACMS, and I guess in a sense the Storm Shadow. But is the West holding back only because of fears of Ukraine, doing to like Moscow what Russia's doing to Kyiv or Kharkiv? Or is it also because of scarcity, because we haven't invested much into non-nuclear missiles because we're so focused on fancy aircraft and those systems and maybe like cruise missiles?
I think it's a mix of all of those things. So I think, first of all, Ukraine has actually had a lot of success, I think, with their long-range drones. It's just that the long-range drones can only pack so much payload. So if you remember sort of like Operation Spiderweb, that was drones, and they have been able to hit some refineries. And so I think they actually have been pretty effective with drones, but the payload is low.
Right.
They have a number of missile programs that they've been working on, actually, trying to develop longer range missiles. I mean, their Neptune missile, which is originally an anti-ship missile, has actually been quite effective. Mm-hmm. They have a land version, but it's like not quite as good. I mean, not quite as accurate.
Right.
Can't go quite as far as what they're hoping. So that, their main or their longest range missile program is this Flamingo.
Yeah.
Missile.
It's kind of a boondoggle, isn't it?
Well, right now it's really big, and it's not So it's easy to intercept because it's slow and it's not very precise. So it's useful for like overwhelming air defense targets or air defenses, but not that useful for hitting targets. And it's not that cheap to produce, and Ukraine can't produce that many of them. So they lost a lot of this capacity to produce these types of munitions. And yeah, they have scientists, but and they're working on it. Just it takes time, and getting them the right technology and missile technology is quite sophisticated. So it's something that I think they're still working on. And obviously, they have a lot of demands on their like defense capacity and production. And so I think it maybe wasn't the first priority. You know, getting ammunition was the first priority.
Right.
I think the reason that the West hasn't given more of these longer-range missiles to Ukraine is really about, scarcity is not irrelevant. The West does not have a lot of them. ATACMS is a great example. The U.S. for a long time stopped producing ATACMS and actually isn't really producing them anymore for the U.S. The U.S. is pivoting to the PrSM missile. I think they are producing some ATACMS now for sale, but they, for a long time, weren't producing ATACMS. So at the time when the Ukraine war is going on, the U.S. had a limited stockpile, and anything they gave away, they couldn't really replace that. It was sort of irreplaceable. The other concerns were, number one, these missiles required significant U.S. assistance for targeting and operation. So it involved a much more extensive use of U.S. military forces and involvement in the conflict, which was an escalation risk concern that Russia would see this as, the U.S. or Europe entering as combatants. And then there's the concern of just simply escalation risks. Like, do you want to enable Ukraine to hit targets deep inside of Russia? Because that could...
Right, like, do you want a vengeance strike on the Kremlin? Because that was booted around, and that clearly scared people in the Pentagon.
And several times now, Ukraine has used long-range strike capabilities, not missiles, but drones, to hit pieces of Russia's nuclear architecture, right? The nuclear bombers, as well as early warning radars.
Yes.
And so this, to me, this is a real escalation risk. If Russia believes that Ukraine, which it sees as a Western proxy operating with Western intelligence, is using Western weapons to hit pieces of its nuclear infrastructure, how does it respond? To me, that's a real escalation risk concern. So I have always been, and the other factor here, it's important to keep in mind, is that it's not clear that having long-range missiles would change the trajectory of this war.
Yes.
It would allow Ukraine to impose more costs on Russia. Mm-hmm. It would increase escalation risks. But ultimately, no matter how many missiles the West was willing to give, it was always going to be fewer than Russia had. And in order to actually do significant damage and cause a strategic shift in Russia, the number of missiles that Ukraine would need is greater than the number of missiles that the West really could provide.
Right.
So, yes, could long-range missiles help on the margins? Yes, it could. They could help with things like taking out some of the launch platforms that Russia uses to launch drones and rockets and missiles into Ukraine. But would that help change the trajectory of the war? No, it would help on the margins with air defense. Thinking about the future, Ukraine believes that having long-range strike capability is essential to its security. And for Russia, Ukraine having long-range strike capability is a red line. And so I think this is actually an area where negotiations will be quite interesting to watch, and I'm not sure how they'll turn out, because Russia will want caps and Ukraine will not want caps. And Russia is winning the war, but I'm not sure they have enough to win decisively enough that they'll get to dictate this. So I do think the question, I think a reasonable compromise would be Ukraine keeps its own domestic production and doesn't get any Western weapons. Its domestic production is not that great and not really a threat. So maybe that's sort of the medium-term middle ground.
Right. Well, that leads me maybe to the last question, because I know you're going to have to go shortly. But you're based in D.C., you move around sort of defense circles, and you've written some great articles. And but also, you've met with, like, I think last year you met with some Ukrainian officials, and you're at these different conferences. And I'm just wondering how realistic, how close or not at all close are we to maybe seeing a negotiated, settlement end to this? I mean, horrible war, just incredibly just. Deadly as hell and horrific war. And I agree with you. Yeah, Russia is winning, winning the war of attrition. I think that's been how it's been since Putin did his mobilization in 2022. That pretty much changed it forever. But Ukraine is still fighting on, and the Europeans do not want this war to stop, it seems to me. So what do you think the chances are of a negotiated settlement, or by when?
I guess I'm reasonably optimistic that the war could end by, like, maybe later this year or early next year. But I don't think it's because of the success of diplomacy as much as it will be because of changes on the battlefield that will make peace more, like, the terms are, I don't think the terms are going to change. I think ultimately it'll just be that the terms are acceptable to both sides because of changes on the battlefield. I think Ukraine is near a point of exhaustion, and I think Russia at some point will decide that the continuing costs of the war are just too high to keep going. And so if they can get a minimally sufficient outcome, I think they'll accept it. But my problem with the current peace process is I just think it's based on the wrong thing. Like, there's this idea that we can trade security guarantees for territory and that will end the war. And I think that's wrong for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think if you look at the Russian statements closely, they make it clear that territory isn't the last thing they want. It's the first thing they need before they'll talk about the rest of the stuff. So the reason they haven't litigated every point of the 20-point plan is because the 20-point plan is irrelevant until Ukraine withdraws. And it's the withdrawal piece is important because it suggests
withdrawal from Donbass, you mean?
Yeah, the rest of Donbass. They want that withdrawal because it will be a signal of Ukraine's capitulation, that Ukraine recognizes it's lost.
Right.
But the bigger problem here is that this trade between security guarantees and territory doesn't address the fundamental issue at the core of the war, which is both sides' security concerns. It does nothing to address Russia's concerns about Ukraine being a Western proxy, about having NATO forces in Ukraine or NATO weapons in Ukraine. It does nothing to offer Russia assurances that Ukraine won't become a NATO member or Ukraine's military won't pose a threat. On the Ukrainian side, there's really, like, they understand that even if the West promises security guarantees, they are not really real, that no one's going to fight for Ukraine but Ukraine. And so this trade leaves them more vulnerable. It forces them to give up strategic territory for some empty promise that they're not sure is going to materialize. It does nothing to promise them that they'll have the sort of military capabilities internally to not, you know, defeat Russia, but to deter a future invasion by just making it too costly. And so it doesn't address these security concerns. And so the paradigm that we're using right now, or that the negotiators are trying to push forward, is just the wrong frame. And so I don't think it will work.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is one of these wars that the political the politics of it will be decided on the battlefield ultimately. I completely agree with your assessment of that, which is always wonderful to have agreement. Jennifer, thank you so much for talking to us and coming on Radio War Nerd, and looking forward to reading more of your articles.
Yes, thank you very much.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed the conversation a lot.
Thank you, Jennifer. Okay, we'll end the episode here. Thank you again to Jennifer Kavanaugh from the Defense Priorities, and also author of articles that I'll post at Responsible Statecraft. Thank you, everybody. John, Brendan, and talk to you soon.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.